From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the sixth and final segment in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order as seen from contemporary and historical perspectives. The program at hand focuses on the research of one scholar at the National Humanities Center. He is Houston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania, where he holds the Greenfield Chair in Human Relations. Professor Baker is the author of a forthcoming book entitled The Afro-American Matrix, an examination of blues, etiology, and the study of literature, criticism, and culture in America. The conversation begins with Professor Baker's comments on definitions of the blues and their centrality to Afro-American culture.
Well, it's an interesting question. I suppose a number of people would define it in long and elaborate terms, but one definition that the singers themselves use is that the blues ain't nothing but a good man or a good woman feeling bad. The cryptic statement of definition of the blues in the way of all cryptic statements, it seems to me, captures one of the intrinsic aspects of the blues. You talk about the blues and you hear people singing lustily, you look and there's a smile on their face, you see a whole community, an audience patting its feet and getting happy, and you say, well, I thought this was the blues, they're supposed to be sad. I think there's a kind of oxymoronic effect in the blues, happy sadness. You mm-hmm. sing because you're feeling bad. And it seems to me that if you press the definition that comes out of that cryptic statement and the happy sadness, what you get, Wayne, is a situation where you have a culture, a whole way of life, a group of people in America who came up under some of the hardest times imaginable, but survived those times. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that they survived those times was by singing the blues. They sang about their troubles. They formed a community through common expression. They brought together a number of aspects of their verbal and musical experience in the blues. The only way to talk about Afro-American culture is to talk about it in blues terms. And when I say blues terms, what I mean is this sense of the contradictions, the happy sadness, mm-hmm. the singing when one is feeling bad, because the truth is that I suppose that people were always feeling bad. Mm-hmm. If you were plowing from the first light of day until after the sun went down sure. at night, it wasn't a very pleasant existence.
This was not 9 to 5.
This was not 9 to 5. This went on as long as the person who was in charge of your life, the overseer, mm-hmm. the master of the plantation, wanted you to do it in any season, four mm-hmm. seasons of the year. And the blues start as a kind of simple form, that is the form of the field holler. Someone like Leadbelly, for example, does an extraordinary field holler, and it's simply the voice resonating through various changes. And if you had a person in a field a quarter of a mile down the road, he would say, oh, that's Pete hollering at the end of the day, and he might give an answering holler. And that's one of the aspects that forms the amalgam of the blues. You have simple musical performances and other things as well. Why don't we listen to an example of the field holler, Wayne? This is Leadbelly singing or doing a field holler.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an example of the single voice without instruments and expressing some of that hardness of life behind the mule, as it were. But there's another way of doing that, and that would be in the way that Sleepy John Estes does it when he sings about rats in my kitchen. A simple enough phrase, but when one considers that the kitchen was also the living room and was also the bedroom, because these cabins in the middle of fields, which had very little insulation and were cold in winter and hot in summer, formed the kitchen and everything else. And you think of rats in my kitchen, and the way Sleepy John handles it in ironic terms, it gives you some sense of that singing when you're feeling bad and triumphing over the evil of a plantation system through song. Why don't we listen to Sleepy John Estes do Rats in My Kitchen?
Oh, them rat is mean in my kitchen. I have all a meal my cat. Oh, dumb rat is mean in my kitchen. I have all a meal my cat. You know the way they strung my growth, but the clap is tight like that. Now 61 and 62 red, but it sure did treat me mean. I'm 61 and 62 red, but it sure did treat me mean. You know they took me off a pork chop, but they put me on fat back and pinto me.
Houston, tell me about what distinction there might be between the blues, the stuff that we've been listening to now, from other early forms of black music in America. Was it always, did it always sound this way?
Well, one of the sure correlatives to talking about Afro-American culture is that the person who does it is going to bring up the spirituals. The spirituals are almost the distinctive signature of Afro-American culture.
Now, is this what would be called gospel music today?
No. When you talk about the blues, you talk about usually a single singer, and the audience is there, but the audience is saying things like, Lord, 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 ain't it the truth now? or other kinds of phrases while the singer does the entire song. And in the blues, the I, that is the first person personal pronoun, is dominant. It's there, but it's an I that is always a communal I, and you know it's communal because people say, "La la la, ain't it the truth?" Now, I'd like to think of gospel music as an amalgam of sacred and secular tonalities. So the gospel is, in one sense, the farthest reach of, how to say, a religious, quote religious, end of quote, tradition in Afro-American music, just as, oh, let us say, new wave jazz would be the farthest extension of what one might want to call a secular aspect of Afro-American music. Let me give you an example. If we look at a traditional spiritual, though one to be sure arranged by a brilliant arranger, William Dawson, who's worked out of Tuskegee many, many years of his life, let's look at There Is a Balm in Gilead. the way that's sung, and then we'll contrast that with a slow secular song, Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman. Now that we've heard the Dawson arrangement, which I think you'll agree is extraordinary, and you can see the way that the line of recitative combines with the refrain there, that wonderful voice of the male singer, and then the chorus coming in, let's listen to Skip James do Devil Got My Woman, which is a rather remarkable blues.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the sixth and final segment in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. My guest is Houston Baker, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book entitled The Afro-American Matrix, an examination of blues, etiology, and the study of literature, criticism, and culture in America. Do you have to be black, really, to appreciate and enjoy the blues?
In a sense, I would almost make the at first blush, outlandish statement that you have to be black to understand what it means to be an American. Uh-huh. You know, but I would expect someone to make a similar statement and say, well, that is absolutely ridiculous. You have to be Indian in order to know what it means to be American. What I want to indicate by those claims or statements, as outlandish as they may sound, is that we have a fairly restricted definition of what it means to be American. What I want to indicate is that the definition that we have of American is fairly restricted. When I say we, I mean everyone who inhabits space in what we call these United States, because definitions are perpetuated by a power elite, And the definition of American has certainly shared that and has come down to, for the most part, white New England, rich, well-educated, solvent, well-spoken males who control the publishing companies, the concept of history. And if you stand outside that definition of American, you're automatically a stranger, an alien, a subculture, someone who's supposed to go in the melting pot and come out looking presumably like a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, well-educated, well-spoken male, which might be damned hard for, say, a black woman to do, or for an Indian man, or for a black man to do. That power elite has tried to make us feel like strangers. And the fact is that if we take a broader definition of America and have someone say to us, well, you have to be black to understand the blues, that should be a joyful thing. We'd say, well, good, let me try to become black long enough to understand these. And if someone says, well, you have to be Indian to understand The Way to Rainy Mount by Scott and Mamaday, you say, well, good, let me understand what it means to be Indian in order to understand that. In one sense, there ain't no strangers here. Everybody's been here before. They are the always already that constitutes what it means to be American in any pluralistic sense of the word. Robert Johnson has a song called Crossroads Blues, and he talks about what it means to be a stranger at the crossroads. And I think we'll have a listen to that. What we have in the Robert Johnson song, is a man who is at the crossroads. The crossroads are extraordinarily important in African culture, Caribbean culture, and Afro-American culture. Eshua Legba is the trickster figure who stands at the crossroads in African lore. Anansi the spider is the trickster of and the person who's a crossroads, a threshold figure in Caribbean lore. And for Robert Johnson, the saying about being a stranger at the crossroads here means that he's an extraordinarily powerful figure. But he's a figure who recognizes the trouble around him, and at the end he says, go get my friend and tell him I'm slowly sinking down. One of the reasons for this sinking down is, as he says in an earlier verse, ain't nobody seemed to know me, everybody passed me by. But the eye who's sinking down to the extent that this trickster, powerful folk figure is not recognized at the crossroads is all of us. And there's another blues verse that says, if you see me coming, better open up your doors. I ain't no stranger. I've been here before. And I think there's some of the signification of that phrasing in Robert Johnson's Crossroad Blues. To a certain extent, I suppose, it's essential that we realize that we are all wounded, that we realize that we are all without cure in the sense that cure implies we're fixed, we're final, this is our form forever. We're all without cure. We're all wounded. We're all in error. We're all wandering. And I think what we don't want is the kind of solution that we would traditionally think of as a cure. I think what we want is to open things up, a kind of opening that would allow for a total redefinition, so that we wouldn't begin with the phrase, for example, that the blues was down on the cultural ladder. We would sort of begin by destroying both the notion of culture with a capital C and the notion that there is an ascendancy of, mm-hmm. of forms from, let us say, low to high. We would break up all the traditional dichotomies. I would certainly hope that to turn attention to a form of expression like the blues would open up a realm that has to become more important for American studies in the future, mm-hmm. and that's the realm called the vernacular. The vernacular. A poet like Walt Whitman knew that the glory of America did not lay in its statesmen and its politicians and its theaters, but in the common man. And Whitman says, these two are unsung poetry, and it awaits the enormous effort, presumably, of course, of someone like Whitman himself, who recognized mm-hmm. the force of the vernacular in American culture. The blues, for me, is a sign of the vernacular in American culture. Interestingly enough, Wayne, one of the roots of vernacular is verna, V-E-R-N-A, which is Old French, signifying a slave who's born on his master's estate. And certainly nobody fits that definition more than Afro-Americans in this country.
Well, Houston, I'm not sure if you approve of pushing the parallel this far, that the blues represent a kind of black Walt Whitman influence, something like that. But it sounds to me as though you're arguing that the blues really can be an element in getting Americans to take their pluralism seriously. They talk about it a lot. But what you've been suggesting here is that they don't really take it that seriously.
Oh, yes. That's an excellent way of phrasing it, Wayne. It seems to me that if I, as a scholar, and a number of scholars who precede me and far excel me in their understanding of the blues, a person like Sterling Brown or Stephen Henderson, for example, can privilege the blues as a matrix for understanding American culture and have a wide response on the part of American scholars and Americans in general, then it seems to me that we're going to be in a fair way qualified to understand the enormous diversity of our culture and to at least ameliorate our dilemma. There are no solutions to dilemmas, mm-hmm. But certainly to come at some of the more pressing problems of a general American culture, if you will, in far more sagacious ways than we have in the past.
Houston, let's conclude. I want you to reflect on the blues as ideology. You've talked about, well, obviously all of this has political implications. You've talked about who has power, who doesn't have power, how mm-hmm. people express themselves on both sides of that proposition. Are the blues today ideologically motivated?
Ideology comes bearing the imprint of economics. And the blues grow out, Wayne, of what I want to call an economics of slavery. And by an economics of slavery, I mean principally the plantation system in the Americas that sanctioned and employed chattel slaves as means of production. Bucca White, who hates the name or hated the name Bucca because he's Booker T. White, talks about the blues, and he says the blues came out from behind the mule, and that mule was a plantation mule, and people were working awfully hard. And as they did that, they would sing work songs, the field hollers that we've heard already, combine proverbial wisdom with this, sing in the evenings and so forth. To the extent that they did, and they were engaged in that labor that constituted the economics, or that was a part of the economics of slavery, one can talk about the blues as ideologically motivated. Frederick Jameson, brilliant Marxist critic, says that any art form inscribes within its form the conditions of exchange that mark the economics of the era in which it emerged. The blues carry the imprint of slavery. And to the extent that they do, they are ideologically motivated. To ask a question about whether today's manifestations of a blues sensibility or a blues influence, whether those manifestations are ideologically motivated, is to give the answer yes. If we listen to the music, for example, of the 1960s, that music is a kind of social protest movement, music that comes out of the civil rights movement, even out of the Black Power movement. If we listen to some of the Black music of the 1980s, and I think here of someone like Gil Scott Heron singing Tell Me What's the Word in Johannesburg, and doing it with blues tonalities, again, we can answer the question, yes, the blues and the manifestations of the blues are ideologically motivated. If we listen to remakes of some of the early New Orleans jazz that's being done by some of the really avant-garde Black groups today, taking the horn of tonalities of Buddy Bolden and working them into new forms of jazz, and doing it with the intention of preserving and playing with extraordinarily important Afro-American signifiers, and knowing that that's directly related to the conditions of existence of Afro-Americans in this country now, today, then we can say, yes, those blues manifestations are ideologically motivated. They are rooted in an economics of slavery, which to a greater extent than most would like to admit, has been perduring from 1619 to 1983.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the final segment in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. My guest was Houston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Baker recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he finished his forthcoming book entitled The Afro-American Matrix. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the sixth and final segment in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. My guest is Houston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Baker discusses his forthcoming book, The Afro-American Matrix, an examination of the blues, etiology, and the study of literature, criticism, and culture in America. What are the blues? Why is this Afro-American form of expressive culture important to Black and white Americans today? Listen for some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.